Hello and welcome to the SRNA Ask the Expert podcast series. I'm Gigi DeFebri with the Siegel Rare Neuroimmune Association. For this episode, Understanding Optic Neuritis, Causes, Treatments, and Repair, I'm pleased to be joined by Dr. Michael Levy and Dr. Benjamin Greenberg. Dr. Michael Levy is the Research Director of the Division of Neuroimmunology and Neuroinfectious Disease at Mass General Hospital, and Dr. Benjamin Greenberg is a professor and the Kane Denius Scholar in Mobility Disorders in the Department of Neurology at UT Southwestern Medical Center. You can find their full bios in the podcast description. SRNA is a nonprofit focused on support, education, and research of rare neuroimmune disorders. You can learn more about us on our website at wearesrna.org. This episode is made possible in part by the generous support of Amgen, Alexion AstraZeneca Rare Disease, Genentech, and UCB. Thank you for joining me today to talk about optic neuritis and treatments and potential remyelination of the optic nerve. So to start with just the basics, what is optic neuritis in plain language, or what symptoms might someone notice? Dr. Levy?
Optic neuritis in its simplest form is just inflammation of the optic nerve. The optic nerve is the nerve that connects the eye to the brain, and it carries all the information into the brain. And when the optic nerve is inflamed, then the messages coming from the eye are interrupted. It might be on one side, or with MOG, it tends to sometimes be both sides. But what people notice first is from the inflammation itself. They may notice pain, especially when they move their eyes. And then they may notice a gray spot or even total loss of vision, depending on how severe it is. And that evolves over usually a period of 1 to a few days, and it can just get worse and worse till it reaches a nadir. That's often when people present, then they come in for treatment, and in some cases, they can improve, especially with MOG, and in some cases with idiopathic optic neuritis. The most common cause of optic neuritis is multiple sclerosis, and that can be diagnosed often when patients present, but sometimes it takes time for MS to become more obvious.
Got it. So yeah, so when someone has optic neuritis, does that kind of automatically mean they have another condition, or can it happen on its own, like you said, idiopathic optic neuritis? How often do you kind of see it more associated with another condition, or just happening on its own as kind of a one-time event?
Yeah, I think the latest numbers are something like 50% of all optic neuritis is multiple sclerosis, then like 35% being idiopathic, meaning it's a one and done, one time event. We don't really know why. And then the other 15% is everything else: MOG, neuromyelitis optica, chronic relapsing optic neuropathy, and many other conditions that can inflame the optic nerve, but all bundled into that one 15% compartment.
Got it. And so are there differences between optic neuritis that's associated with MS versus NMOSD or MOGAD, Dr. Greenberg?
Yeah, there are. The differences are across several different categories. One is the demographic of the populations that suffer from these different disorders. Anti-MOG associated disorder is more prevalent onset in pediatric populations than adult, but affects both. Whereas aquaporin-4 mediated disease is very unusual in prepubescent children, highly unusual. Likewise, multiple sclerosis is unusual in prepubescent children. Post-puberty, it starts to increase. In anti-MOG associated disorder, particularly in children, the optic neuritis is often bilateral. It can be bilateral in aquaporin-4 disease, highly unusual to be bilateral in multiple sclerosis, meaning are both eyes affected at the same time or just one eye? In multiple sclerosis, it's almost always one eye at a time. The features are quite similar. So pain with eye movement, blurred vision, because whether the inflammation was there because of anti-MOG associated disorder or aquaporin-4 disease or multiple sclerosis, symptomatically they can look similar. But on exam, there can be some differences. So in multiple sclerosis, the way I was taught many, many, many years ago was the patient sees nothing and the doctor sees nothing. Meaning when I go to raise my ophthalmoscope and look in the back of the eye, in the acute setting, the optic nerve looks normal in optic neuritis associated with multiple sclerosis. That's not the same for anti-MOG associated disorder. Sometimes we'll see changes around the disc or even in aquaporin-4 disease. So my exam can be a little different between them. The severity tends to be more severe, and I stress the word tends, in aquaporin 4 mediated disease, then anti-MOG associated disorder, then multiple sclerosis in that order. But multiple sclerosis patients can have severe disease, and aquaporin 4 positive patients can have mild disease. So it's a trend, it's not a rule. And then finally, relative to recovery, if I had to rank order recovery after optic neuritis, my personal ranking would be my anti-MOG associated disorder patients recover the best, my multiple sclerosis patients are in the middle, and my patients with aquaporin 4 mediated NMO have the least or most limited recovery. So there are lots of different differences between them, that the challenge is for each, any one of those categories, it's a Venn diagram. There's always an exception to the rule. So is there a pre-pubescent child who's had aquaporin 4 mediated disease unilaterally with great recovery? Yes. So the rules only help us so far, but it helps us scientifically to try and understand these conditions, to compare and contrast those features, to get at root causes and what's happening biologically.
Okay. And so what should happen when someone first develops optic neuritis? What tests are usually done to understand optic neuritis? Are there tests done to kind of look at the optic nerve, but what about any blood tests for aquaporin 4 or MOG? So what happens kind of when someone first develops optic neuritis, Dr. Levy?
Well, usually people present to an ophthalmologist because they're thinking there's something wrong with their vision. They go in, they get checked out. As Dr. Greenberg was saying, most of the time the eye looks fine to the ophthalmologist. But since the patient can't see well out of the eye, then the ophthalmologist figures, okay, there must be something wrong with the nerves behind the eye that they can't see. So then they send them to the emergency room or to a neuro-ophthalmologist or a neurologist, where the first test will be an MRI. An MRI should really show the inflammation in the optic nerve. If it doesn't show any inflammation, it still could be an optic neuritis or optic neuropathy, but it'll take a lot more thinking to figure out what's going on. Usually there's a lesion, it's identifiable. And once we can identify the inflammation, we can start to make guesses about what's causing it. If it's MS, there are usually additional lesions in the brain and other places. If it's NMO, it might be long or in a certain location. And if it's MOG, might have other characteristics like inflammation around the lining. So then we can start to guess about what it is, but really it'll take a lot of testing. There's blood testing, spinal fluid testing for MS, antibody testing, and then ruling out other causes. So I would say usually by day 10, when all the antibody tests come back and spinal fluid tests come back, we can have a pretty good sense of what caused it.
Okay. And so how do we currently treat an optic neuritis attack, Dr. Greenberg?
So like most central nervous system inflammatory conditions, the first step is to put the fire out. And so the same tools we use to put the fire out in the spinal cord and in the brain are used for the optic nerve. The cornerstone for decades has been high dose corticosteroids. And I really want to stress for folks listening, it used to be there was a confusion that people would say the first treatment is intravenous corticosteroids. It turns out it's not the route of administration that's the key, it's the dose that is used. And so high doses are the standard for anywhere from 3 to 5 days of a high dose. And then depending on the severity and or if we know the underlying cause, additional interventions may be warranted. I'd say these days the most common is plasmapheresis, sometimes called plasma exchange. And then in some indications, IVIG, in particular, sometimes with anti-MOG associated disorder. We tend not to use IVIG in idiopathic optic neuritis, multiple sclerosis, or neuromyelitis optica. So I'd say if you look throughout the United States and frankly the world, the most common combination is steroids with or without plasma exchange as being the acute intervention. The second job is alongside of that, everything Dr. Levy pointed out in terms of diagnostic testing, finding the underlying cause to determine does somebody need long-term preventative therapy to prevent the relapse.
Got it. And so what does recovery from optic neuritis typically look like? Do some people recover a lot of vision? Do they not? What does the kind of long-term outcomes look like?
Yeah, it's a great question. And if it's okay, I want to jump in because I love this question, Mike. So there are lots of different ways to measure visual recovery. And the traditional one that's been used, I think, is incomplete. So the traditional one that's used is what's called a high contrast visual acuity measure, meaning, and we've all done it, the black letters on the white piece of paper or the illuminated cabinet, and we cover one eye and it starts with a big E and then it gets smaller and smaller and you read the letters across and we give a number, 20/20, 20/40, 20/60 vision. And for some of us who need corrective lenses, even at our baseline because of the shape of our eye, those little letters are a little blurry and we need help focusing in. With optic nerve damage, people can have a blurred vision as we get to the small letters, so they could have visual acuity that's not their baseline. Instead of 20/20, it might be 20/40 or 20/60. That recovery has been measured over months, if not years. And so we used to say 6 months, it's probably longer than that. There's visual recovery happening well after 6 months. But that measure, the black letters on a white background, is a very specific part of our vision. When we talk to our patients who have 20/20 vision by that measure, a lot of them will still have visual symptoms. Difficulty judging edges of stairs, contrast issues, particularly at night, glares or halos around lights at night, particularly headlights coming at them. So there are a variety of vision-related functions in life that can be suboptimal, even with 20/20 vision. And so if we, instead of using black letters on a whiteboard, go to gray or off-white letters, what we call low contrast visual acuity, that's really, really where we're challenging the visual symptom. And it's probably a better outcome measure for trials, because it's a lot harder to see an off-white letter on a whiteboard than a black letter. And that probably correlates better with people's overall visual function in the world.
Got it. And so we talked about the kind of traditional acute therapies that are being used for optic neuritis, but there are new treatments being studied for acute optic neuritis. And I am going to do a terrible job pronouncing this. Is it Privosegtor?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you. I feel like I have said that 1,000 times before, but I just can't. I got to practice it a bit more. So that's a treatment that's being studied for acute optic neuritis. And it seems like it's not trying to suppress the immune system, but is looking more at being a neuroprotective treatment. So do you mind just talking a little bit about how it might protect the optic nerve during an acute optic neuritis attack to help improve recovery or reduce these kind of long-term visual issues, Dr. Levy?
Yeah. So Privosegtor comes out of a lab in Spain that was looking for different molecules that protects nerves under certain conditions of inflammation. And they happened upon several different molecules that they then trialed, and Privosegtor emerged as one of the best, and they've gone all the way through phase 2 trials already, demonstrating that when a patient takes Privosegtor after optic neuritis, there is an improved outcome several weeks later. And again, it's not reduced inflammation, as you're saying. It's not improved myelination or remyelination. It seems to protect the nerves, so the nerves don't die in the acute setting. And as the remyelination progresses, the nerve can remain there and become remyelinated. That's as best as we understand this molecule. It's a brand new molecule, hasn't been approved for anything else, and is now in a phase 3 trial for optic neuritis and for vascular injury of the optic nerve as well.
Got it. And is it for optic neuritis of any, due to any of the conditions we talked about, or just idiopathic optic neuritis with MS?
I don't really know. Dr. Greenberg, do you know if I've checked the...
So I'd have to look back at the phase 2 trial, which was the acuity trial, in terms of if they excluded individuals with known background autoimmune disorders. So my understanding is they excluded people with anti-aquaporin 4 associated with neuromyelitis optica, or people who had evidence of multiple sclerosis or MOGAD. And so they were really looking for people who had optic neuritis without a known explanation. And so that's not to say that their intervention wouldn't work in those individuals, but similar to some things we've discussed in the past, for the purpose of the clinical trial, They weren't testing it in individuals with those conditions.
Got it. Okay. And then
I will say, though, it's not unusual when somebody shows up with optic neuritis for the first time for us to have a couple weeks before we get back an antibiotic antibody or an aquaporin 4 antibody. So inevitably, this is going to be used in individuals where we just don't know they have that antibody. But if you were a previously identified patient, you wouldn't be able to enroll in the trial.
Got it. Okay. And then there's another treatment being studied in adults with acute optic neuritis, efgartigimod alpha. I don't know if I said that correctly. I feel like both of these are particularly challenging for, but anyway, so this one works by lowering levels of IgG antibodies. So why would this potentially help during an acute optic neuritis attack, Dr. Greenberg?
Well, this may be one of Dr. Weavy's favorite topics.
I'm going to defer
to Mike on this one.
Please.
A lot of people are familiar with plasma exchange. It's like a filtration of the blood, like dialysis, that removes antibodies and other factors. And it really helps, especially in optic neuritis from aquaporin 4 disease and related conditions. What efgartigimod does is it triggers a lowering of antibodies in the circulation to the same degree as plasma exchange, but no filtration required. So they come in, they get their shot of steroids, they get this shot of efgartigimod, and then the antibodies start to decline. And the pharmacokinetics are pretty good. Over the course of a week, they'll almost be at the same level as if you just completed plasma exchange. And so we want to know, is that sufficient? Could that replace plasma exchange? Could we offer this to patients with severe optic neuritis, severe or moderate optic neuritis? And then they don't have to undergo plasma exchange. So those trials are underway right now. We're including all first comers optic neuritis, but we really are trying to emphasize the ones who respond to plasma exchange, like NMO and MOG. But we have been getting a lot of MS cases too, because MS patients can have severe optic neuritis as well.
Got it. And so just a follow up. So if it's, you know, in terms of thinking about plasma exchange and what that is used for, in terms of something like myelitis, is it possible that this in the future could be used to kind of potentially replace plasma exchange in that context as well? Or is that...
No, that's exactly the hope. Okay. Plasma exchange is 10 days in the hospital. It's a big catheter in your neck or in your chest, and it has a lot of problems. And if we could reproduce the results with just a shot, that would be amazing. So that's really what we're trying to achieve here.
Definitely. Okay, great. All right, so moving on to repair. So we've talked about the kind of acute attack, what happens there, what's currently used, what's being studied. And so once someone has this optic neuritis attack and then potentially has damage left over from that, what we think about potentially repairing the optic nerve. So how should patients think about the difference between repairing versus treating inflammation? And Dr. Levy, if you want to go first.
Yeah. So when we think about treating inflammation, we're trying to get the immune cells out of the optic nerve. It's more like putting out the fire, as Dr. Greenberg mentioned before. And those mechanisms can be applicable to transverse myelitis and any other brain inflammation, as we talked about. But remyelination is a whole separate thing. It's where we're really trying to regrow myelin, where myelin has been lost. There have been several attempts at remyelination, but there's no drug yet that we have to remyelinate in any indication. So that's really a goal for the future. Right now, what we can do is reduce inflammation. We can reduce inflammation in many different ways, and hopefully with the private sector can protect the nerve so that ultimately when we do have a treatment for remyelination, the nerves will survive.
Got it. And so why is remyelinating or repairing the optic nerve so challenging, Dr. Levy?
Well, repairing any nerve is challenging. And remyelination, we haven't had any breakthroughs yet. But as I said, there have been many attempts. In the lab, remyelination works fairly well in mice. Even after optic neuritis, we can intervene in many different ways to try to regrow myelin, from stem cells to different medications that have been shown to be helpful. But whenever these are have been attempted to be translated to humans, they just don't work as well. And so we're not giving up. There's still many different attempts and different studies coming out of the labs, but right now we're at the point where we're just trying to make something work in the human case.
Yeah. So, Dr. Greenberg, we've heard about Q cells. I know you've given some talks about the Q study, specifically in myelitis, but how might this be applicable to optic neuritis?
So relative to optic neuritis and any demyelinating disorder, there are several different strategies to try and repair. So one is to use drugs to induce endogenous cells within a person to make new myelin and repair damage. The other is to introduce exogenous cells into a person's nervous system to make the myelin. And Q cells represent that second approach. Can we take off-the-shelf stem cells, put them into a human, have them replicate and make myelin and repair the damage that's been done? And it's something we're actively studying in a phase one trial for myelitis patients. Dr. Levy and I have talked about how do we get this into the optic nerve. And while we know the cells in animals work, and we now have human data that we're gathering, we have to get them to the site of injury. And the optic nerve is thin and long and in your cranium. And so the trick is the approach, the actual surgical approach to injecting the cells into that optic nerve. And I know Dr. Levy's working with colleagues in Boston, and there's a couple other groups around who are trying to tackle this issue of delivery. We, despite the best advertisements from so-called stem cell clinics around the world, the intravenous administration of these cells does not work for repair. In fact, the intrathecal administration of these cells is likely very limited, if at all, for repair. The cells don't get to the site of injury at the amount we need to actually repair. So everybody should save their money and not fly to a destination country of choice or have a boutique clinic come to your house with their supposed stem cell therapies. The reason this is taking a long time is administration is hard, and we're trying to sort that out for the optic nerve.
Got it. Okay. All right. Well, thank you both so much for taking the time to talk about optic neuritis. Really appreciate it.
We appreciate it. Thank you.
Thank you to our Ask the Expert sponsors, Amgen, Alexion AstraZeneca Rare Disease, Genentech, and UCB. Amgen is focused on the discovery, development, and commercialization of medicines that address critical needs for people impacted by rare, autoimmune, and severe inflammatory diseases. They apply scientific expertise and courage to bring clinically meaningful therapies to patients. Amgen believes science and compassion must work together to transform lives. Alexion AstraZeneca Rare Disease is a global biopharmaceutical company focused on serving patients with severe and rare disorders through the innovation, development, and commercialization of life-transforming therapeutic products. Their goal is to deliver medical breakthroughs where none currently exist, and they are committed to ensuring that patient perspective and community engagement are always at the forefront of their work. Founded more than 40 years ago, Genentech is a leading biotechnology company that discovers, develops, manufactures, and commercializes medicines to treat patients with serious and life-threatening medical conditions. The company, a member of the Roche Group, has headquarters in South San Francisco, California. For additional information about the company, please visit www.gene.com. UCB innovates and delivers solutions that make real improvements for people living with severe diseases. They partner with and listen to patients, caregivers, and stakeholders across the healthcare system to identify promising innovations that create valuable health solutions.